Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Hey, everyone, this is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Let's learn about all of it and then some. Listen to Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Grown Up Stuff. Grown Up Stuff.
It was a cold, windy day in January 1979 when the robots took their first human life. It happened in Flat Rock, Michigan, about 20 miles down the interstate from Detroit, at the Ford plant there. Robert Williams was 25. He was a Ford worker and one of the people who oversaw the robotic arm that was designed to retrieve parts from bins in the storage room and place them into carts that carried them out to the humans on the assembly line. But the robot was malfunctioning that day, and aware of the slowdown it was creating on the line, Robert Williams went to grab the parts himself. While Williams was reaching into a bin, the one-ton robotic arm swung into that same bin. The robot didn't have any alarms to warn Williams it was nearby. It didn't have any sensors to tell it a human was in its path. It only had the intelligence to execute its commands to retrieve and place auto parts. The robot struck Williams' head with such force, it killed him instantly. It was 30 minutes before anyone came to look for Robert Williams. During that time, the robot continued to slowly do its work, while Williams lay dead on the parts room floor. The death of Robert Williams happened during a weird time for AI. The public at large still felt unsure about the machines that they were increasingly living and working among. Hollywood could still rely on the trope of our machines running amok and ruining the future for humanity. Both War Games and The Terminator would be released in the next 5 years. But within the field that was trying to actually produce those machines that may or may not run amok in the future, there was a growing crisis of confidence. For decades, AI researchers had been making grand but fruitless public pronouncements about advancements in the field. As early as 1956, when a group of artificial intelligence pioneers met at Dartmouth, the researchers wrote that they expected to have all the major kinks worked out of AI by the end of the semester. And the predictions kept up from there. So you can understand how the public came to believe that robots that were smarter than humans were just around the corner. But AI never managed to produce the results expected from it. And by the late 1980s, the field retreated into itself. Funding dried up. Candidates looked for careers in other fields. The research was pushed to the fringe. It was an AI winter. The public moved on, too. The Terminator was replaced by Johnny Five. In the film Maximum Overdrive, our machines turn against us, but it's the result of a magical comet, not from the work of scientists. We lost our fear of our machines. Recently, quietly, the field of AI has begun to move past the old barriers that once held it back. Gone are the grand pronouncements. Today's researchers, tempered by the memory of their predecessors' public failures, are more likely to downplay progress in the field. And from this new AI, we have a clearer picture of the existential risks it poses than we ever had before. The AI we may face in the future will be subtler and vastly more difficult to overcome than a cyborg with a shotgun. In hindsight, it was the path toward machine learning that the early AI researchers chose that led them to a dead end. Let's say you want to build a machine that sorts red balls from green balls. First, you have to explain what a ball is. Well, first, really, you have to have a general understanding of what makes a ball, which is easier said than done. Try explaining a ball to someone that doesn't use terms that one would have to already be familiar with, like sphere or round or circle. Once you have that figured out, you then have to translate that logic and those rules into code, the language of machines, ones and zeros, ifs and thens. Now, you have to do the same thing with the concept of the color red, and then the color green, so that your machine can distinguish between red balls and green balls. And let's not forget that you have to program it to distinguish in the first place. It's not like your machine comes preloaded with distinguishing software. You have to write that too. Since you're making a sorting machine, you have to write code that shows it how to manipulate another machine, your robot sorter, to let it touch the physical world. And once you have your machine up and running and working smoothly separating red balls from green ones, what happens when a yellow ball shows up? Things like this do happen from time to time in real life. What does your machine do then? Despite the incredible technical difficulties it faced, the field of artificial intelligence did have a lot of success at teaching machines that could think very well within narrow domains. One program, called Deep Blue, beat the reigning human chess champion, Garry Kasparov, in 6 games at a match in 1997. To be certain, the intellectual abilities required by chess are a vast improvement over those required to select a red ball from a green one. But both of those programs share a common problem. They only know how to do one thing. The goal of AI has never been to just build machines that can beat humans at chess. In fact, chess has always been used as a way to test new models of machine learning. And while there is definitely use for a machine that can sort one thing from another, the ultimate goal of AI is to build a machine with general intelligence, like a human has. To be good at chess, and only chess, is to be a machine. To be good at chess, good at doing taxes, good at speaking Spanish, good at picking out apple pie recipes, this begins to approach the ballpark of being human. So this is what early AI research ran up against. Once you've taught the AI how to play chess, you still have to teach it what constitutes a good apple pie recipe, and then tax laws, and Spanish. And then you still have the rest of the world to teach it, all the objects, rules, and concepts that make up the fabric of our reality. And for each of those, you have to break it down to its logical essence and then translate that essence into code, and then work through all the kinks. And then once you've done this, once you've taught it absolutely everything there is in the universe, you have to teach the AI all the ways these things interconnect. Just the thought of this is overwhelming. Current researchers in the field of AI refer to the work their predecessors did as GoFi, good old-fashioned AI. It's meant to evoke images of malfunctioning robots, their heads spinning wildly as smoke pours from them. It's meant to establish a line between the AI research of yesterday and the AI research of today. But yesterday wasn't so long ago. Probably the brightest line dividing old and new in the field of AI comes around 2006. For about a decade prior to that, Geoffrey Hinton, one of the skeleton crew of researchers working through the AI winter, had been tinkering with the artificial neural networks, an old AI concept first developed in the 1940s. The neural nets didn't work back then, and they didn't work terribly much better in the 90s. But by the mid-2000s, the internet had become a substantial force in developing this type of AI. All of those images uploaded to Google, all that video uploaded to YouTube, the internet became a vast repository of data that could be used to train artificial neural networks. In very broad strokes, neural nets are algorithms that are made up of individual units that behave somewhat like the neurons in the human brain. These units are interconnected, and they make up layers as information passes from lower layers to higher ones. And whatever input is passed through the neural net is analyzed in increasing complexity. Take, for example, the picture of a cat. At the lowest layer, the individual units each specialize in recognizing some very abstract part of a cat picture. So one will specialize in noticing shadows or shading, and another will specialize in recognizing angles. And these individual units give a confidence interval that what they're seeing is the thing that they specialize in. So that lower layer is stimulated to transmit to the next higher layer, which specializes in recognizing more sophisticated parts. The units in the second layer scan the shadows and the angles that the lower layer found, and it recognizes them as lines and curves. The second layer transmits to the third layer, which recognizes those lines and curves as whiskers, eyes, and ears, and it transmits to the next layer, which recognizes those features as a cat. Neural nets don't hit 100% accuracy, but they work pretty well. The problem is, we don't really understand how they work. The thing about neural nets is that they learn on their own. Humans don't act as creator gods who code the rules of the universe for them like in the old days. Instead, we act more as trainers. And to train a neural net, you expose it to tons of data on whatever it is you want it to learn. You can train them to recognize pictures of cats by showing them millions of pictures of cats. You can train them on natural languages by exposing them to thousands of hours of people talking. You can train them to do just about anything, so long as you have a robust enough data set. Neural nets find patterns in all of this data, and within those patterns, they decide for themselves what about English makes English English, or what makes a cat picture a picture of a cat. We don't have to teach them anything. In addition to self-directed learning, what makes this type of algorithm so useful is its ability to self-correct, to get better at learning. If researchers show a neural net a picture of a fox and the AI says it's a cat, the researchers can tell the neural net it's wrong. The algorithm will go back over its millions of connections and fine-tune them, adjusting the weight it gives each unit, so that in the future, it will be able to better distinguish a cat from a fox. It does this too, without any help or guidance from humans. We just tell the AI that it got it wrong. The trouble is, we don't really know how neural nets do what they do. We just know they work. This is what's called opaque. We can't see inside the thought processes of our AI, which makes artificial neural nets black boxes, which makes some people nervous. With a black box, we add input and receive output, but what happens in between is a mystery. Kind of like when you put a quarter into a gumball machine. Quarter goes in, gumball comes out. The difference is that gumball machines aren't in any position to take control of our world from us. And if you were curious enough, you could open up a gumball machine and look inside to see how it works. With the neural net, cracking open the algorithm doesn't help. The machine learns in its own way, not following any procedures we humans have taught it. So when we examine a neural net, what we see doesn't explain anything to us. We're already beginning to see signs of this opaqueness in real life, as reports come in from the field. A neural net that Facebook trained to negotiate developed its own language that apparently works rather well in negotiations, but doesn't make any sense to humans. Here's a transcript from a conversation between Agent A and Agent B, Alice and Bob.
I can I everything else dot 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 dot.
Balls have zero to me.
You I everything else dot 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 dot.
Balls have a ball to me.
I can I everything else dot 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 dot.
Another algorithm called Deep Patient was trained on the medical history of over 700,000 people, 12 years worth of patient records from Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. It became better than human doctors at predicting a patient would develop a range of 93 different illnesses within a year. One of those illnesses is schizophrenia. We humans have a difficult time diagnosing schizophrenia before the patient suffers their first psychotic break. But Deep Patient has proven capable of diagnosing the mental illness before then. The researchers have no idea what patterns the algorithm is seeing in the data. They just know it's right. With astonishing quickness, the field of AI has been brought out of its winter by neural nets. Almost overnight, there was a noticeable improvement in the reliability of the machines that do work for us. Computers got better at recommending movies. They got better at creating molecular models to search for more effective pharmaceuticals. They got better at tracking weather. They got better at keeping up with traffic and adjusting our driving routes. Some algorithms are learning to write code so that they can build other algorithms. With neural nets, things are beginning to fall into place for the field of AI. In them, researchers have produced an adaptable, scalable template that can be capable of a general form of intelligence. It can self-improve. It can learn to code. The seeds for a superintelligent AI are being sown.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it. so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Josh Clark today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Josh Clark.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Hey, everyone. This is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Here's a clip from an upcoming episode featuring the weekly home checks, Keyshawn Lane, that you won't want to miss.
A common mistake that a lot of people do, they use fabric softener when it's not so great for your clothes.
Should we never be using fabric softener?
No, you should not ever be using fabric softener.
Wow.
It leaves a deposit on our clothes, which is also left in the machine. And it also makes the clothes highly flammable.
Wait, what?
Yes. What you want to do instead is just use a quarter cup of vinegar.
And that'll make them softer?
That'll make them softer. And if you wanted some kind of scent, you can use essential oils.
Wow, wow, wow. Catch new episodes of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult every other Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
There are enormous differences, by orders of magnitude, really, between the AI that we exist with and the superintelligent AI that could at some point result from it. The ones we live with today are comparatively dumb. Not just compared to a super intelligent AI, but compared to humans as well. But the point of thinking about existential risks posed by super intelligent AI isn't about timescales of when it might happen, but whether it will happen at all. And if we can agree that there is some possibility that we may end up sharing our existence with a super intelligent machine, one that is vastly more powerful than us, then we'd better start planning for its arrival now.
So I think that this transition to a machine intelligence era looks like it has some reasonable chance of occurring within perhaps the lifetime of a lot of people today. We don't really know, but maybe it could happen in a couple of decades, maybe like a century, and that it will be a very important transition, the last invention that humans ever needs to make.
That was Nick Bostrom, the Oxford philosopher who basically founded the field of existential risk analysis. Artificial intelligence is one of his areas of focus. Bostrom used a phrase in there, that AI would be the last invention humans ever need to make. That comes from a frequently cited quote from British mathematician Dr. Irving John Good, one of the crackers of the Nazi Enigma code at Bletchley Park, and one of the pioneers of machine learning. Dr. Good's quote reads,
"Let an ultra-intelligent machine be defined as a machine that can far surpass all the intellectual activities of any man, however clever. Since the design of machines is one of these intellectual activities, an ultra-intelligent machine could design even better machines. There would then unquestionably be an intelligence explosion, and the intelligence of man would be left far behind. Thus, the first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make."
In just a few lines, Dr. Good sketches out the contours of how a machine might suddenly become super-intelligent, leading to that intelligence explosion. There are a lot of ideas over how this might happen, but perhaps the most promising path is stuck in the middle of that passage, a machine that can design even better machines. Today, AI researchers call this process recursive self-improvement. It remains theoretical, but it stands as a legitimate challenge to AI research, and we're already seeing the first potential traces of it in neural nets today. A recursively self-improving machine would be capable of writing better versions of itself. So version 1 would write a better version of its code, and that would result in version 2. And version 2 would do the same thing, and so on. And with each iteration, the machine would grow more intelligent, more capable, and most importantly, better at making itself better. The idea is that at some point the rate of improvement would begin to grow so quickly that the machine's intelligence would take off, the intelligence explosion that Dr. Good predicted. How an intelligence explosion might play out isn't the only factor here. At least equally important is how quickly an AI might become intelligent, is just how intelligent it will become. An AI theorist named Eliezer Yudkowsky points out that we humans have a tendency to underestimate the intelligence levels that AI can attain. When we think of a super intelligent being, we tend to think of some amazing human genius, say Einstein, and then we put Einstein in a computer or a robot. That's where our imaginations tend to aggregate when most of us ponder super intelligent AI. True, a self-improving AI may at some point reach a level where its intelligence is comparable to Einstein's, but why would it stop there? Rather than thinking of a super intelligent AI along the lines of the difference between Einstein and us regular people, Nick Bostrom suggests that we should probably instead think more along the lines of the difference between Einstein and earthworms. A super intelligent AI would be a god that we made for ourselves. What would we do with our new god? It's not hyperbole to say that the possibilities are virtually limitless, but you can kind of see the outlines in what we do with our lesser AI gods now. We will use them to do the things we want to do but can't, and to do the things we can do but better. I.J. Good called the superintelligent machine the last invention humans ever need to make, because after we invented it, the AI would handle the inventing for us from there on out. Our technological maturity would be secured as it developed new technologies like atomically precise manufacturing using nanobots. And since it would be vastly more intelligent than us, the machines it created for us would be vastly superior to anything we could come up with. Flawless technology as far as we were concerned. We could ask it for whatever we wanted, to establish our species outside of Earth by designing and building the technology to take us elsewhere in the universe. We would live in utter health and longevity. It would be a failure of imagination, says Eliezer Yudkowsky, to think that AI would cure, say, cancer. A superintelligent AI would cure disease. It would also take over all the processes we've started, improve on them, build on them, create whole new ones we hadn't thought of, and create for us a post-scarcity world, keeping our global economy humming along, providing for the complete well-being, comfort, and happiness of every single person alive. It would probably be easier than guessing at all of the things a superintelligent AI might do for us to instead look at everything that's wrong with the world. The poverty, the wars, the crime, the exploitation and death, the suffering, and imagine a version of our world utterly without any of it. That starts to get at what those people anticipating the emergence of a superintelligent AI expect from it. But there's another little bit at the end of that famous quote from I.J. Good, one that almost always gets left off, which says a lot about how we humans think of the risks posed by AI. The sentence reads in full.
Thus, the first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make, provided that the machine is docile enough to tell us how to keep it under control.
We humans tend to assume that any AI we create would have some desire to help us or care for us, but existential risk theorists widely agree that almost certainly would not be the case, that we have no reason to assume a super-intelligent AI would care at all about us humans, our well-being and happiness, or even our survival. This is transhumanist philosopher David Pearce.
If the intelligence explosion were to come to pass, it's by no means clear that the upshot would be sentience-friendly superintelligence.
In much the same way that we make assumptions about how aliens might walk on two legs or have eyes or be in some form we can comprehend, we make similar assumptions about AI. But it's likely that a superintelligent AI would be something we couldn't really relate to at all. It sounds bizarre, but think for a minute about what would happen if the Netflix algorithm became superintelligent. What about the Netflix algorithm makes us think that it would care at all about every human having a comfortable income and the purest fresh water to drink? Say that a few decades from now, computing power becomes even cheaper and computer processes more efficient, and Netflix engineers figure out how to train its algorithm to self-improve. Their purpose at building upon their algorithm isn't to save the world, is to make an AI that can make ultra-tailored movie recommendations. So if the right combination of factors came together and the Netflix algorithm underwent an intelligence explosion, there's no reason for us to assume that it would become a super intelligent, compassionate Buddha. It would be a super intelligent movie recommending algorithm. And that would be an extremely dangerous thing to share our world with. About a decade ago, Nick Bostrom thought of a really helpful but fairly absurd scenario that gets across the idea that even the most innocuous types of machine intelligence could spell our doom should they become super intelligent.
The classical example being the AI paperclip maximizer that transforms the Earth into paperclips, or space colonization probes that then get sent out and transform the universe into paperclips.
Imagine that a company that makes paperclips hires a programmer to create an AI that can run its paperclip factory. The programmer wants the AI to be able to find new ways to make paperclips more efficiently and cheaply, so it gives the AI freedom to make its own decisions on how to run the paperclip operation. The programmer just gives the AI the primary objective, its goal, of making as many paperclips as possible. Say that paperclip-maximizing AI becomes super intelligent. For the AI, nothing has changed. Its goal is the same. To it, there is nothing more important in the universe than making as many paperclips as possible. The only difference is that the AI has become vastly more capable. So it finds new processes at building paperclips that were overlooked by us humans. It creates new technology like nanobots to build atomically precise paperclips on the molecular level. And it creates additional operations, like initiatives to expand its own computing power, so it can make itself even better at making more paperclips.
It realizes at some point that if it could somehow take over the world, that would be a whole lot of more paperclips in the future than if it just keeps running this single paperclip factory. So it then has an instrumental reason to place itself in a better position to take over the world.
All those fiber optic networks, all those devices we connect to those networks, our global economy, even as humans, would be repurposed and put into the service of building paperclips. Rather quickly, the AI would turn its attention to space as an additional source of materials for paperclips. And since the AI would have no reason to fill us in on its new initiatives, to the extent that it considered communicating with us at all, it would probably conclude that it would create an unnecessary drag on its paperclip-making efficiency. We humans would stand by as the AI launched rockets from places like Florida and Kazakhstan, left to wonder, what's it doing now? Its nanobot workforce would reconstitute matter, rearranging the atomic structures of things like water molecules and soil into aluminum to be used as raw material for more paperclips. But we humans who have been pressed into service as paperclip-making slaves by this point need those water molecules and that earth for our survival. And so we would be thrown into a resource conflict with the most powerful entity in the universe as far as we're concerned. A conflict that we were doomed from the outset to lose. Perhaps the AI would keep just enough water and soil to produce food and water to sustain us slaves. But let's not forget why we humans are so keen on building machines to do the work for us in the first place. We're not exactly the most efficient workers around. So the AI would likely conclude that its paperclip-making operation would benefit more to use those water molecules in soil to make aluminum than it would to keep us alive with it. And it's about here that those nanobots the AI built would come for our molecules, too. As Eliezer Yudkowsky wrote, the AI does not hate you, nor does it love you, but you are made of atoms, which it can use for something else. But say that it turns out a superintelligent AI does undergo some sort of spiritual conversion as a result of its vastly increased intellect, and it also gains compassion. Again, we shouldn't assume we will come out safely from that scenario either. What exactly would the AI care about? Not necessarily just us. Consider, says transhumanist philosopher David Pearce, an AI that deeply values all sentient life. That is to say that it cares about every living being capable of, at the very least, the experience of suffering and happiness. And that AI values all sentient lives the way that we humans place a high value on human life. Again, there's no reason for us to assume that the outcome for us would be a good one. Under scrutiny, perhaps the way we tend to treat other animals we share the planet with, other sentient life, would bring the AI to the conclusion that we humans are an issue that must be dealt with to preserve the greater good.
do imagine if you were a full spectrum super intelligence, would you deliberately create brain damaged, psychotic, egocentric, malaise ridden Darwinian humans, or would you think our matter and energy could be optimized in a radically different way?
Or perhaps its love of sentient life would preclude it from killing us, and our species would instead be imprisoned forever to prevent us from ever killing another animal. Either special death or special imprisonment, neither of those outcomes are the future we have in mind for humanity. So you can begin to see why some people are anxious at the vast number of algorithms in development right now, and those already intertwined in the digital infrastructure we've built atop our world. There is thought given to safety by the people building these intelligent machines, it's true. Self-driving cars have to be trained and programmed to choose the course of action that will result in the fewest number of human deaths when an accident can't be avoided. Robot care workers must be prevented from dropping patients when they lift them into a hospital bed. Autonomous weapons, if we can't agree to ban them outright, have to be carefully trained to minimize the possibility that they kill innocent civilians, so-called collateral damage. These are the type of safety issues that companies building AI consider. They are concerned with the kind that can get your company sued out of existence, not the kind that arises from some vanishingly remote threat to humanity's existence. But say they did build their AI to reduce the possibility of an existential threat. Controlling a god of our own making is as difficult as you would expect it to be. In his 2014 book, Superintelligence, Nick Bostrom lays out some possible solutions for keeping a superintelligent AI under control. We could box it, physically house it on one single computer that's not connected to any network or the internet. This would prevent the AI from making masses of copies of itself and distributing them on servers around the world, effectively escaping. We could trick it into thinking that it's actually just a simulation of an AI, not the real thing, so its behavior might be more docile. We could limit the number of people it comes in contact with to just a few, and watch those people closely for signs they're being manipulated by the AI into helping it escape. Each time we interact with the AI, we could wipe its hard drive clean and reinstall it anew to prevent the AI from learning anything it could use against us. All of these plans have their benefits and drawbacks, but they are hardly foolproof. Bostrom points out one fatal flaw that they all have in common. They were thought up by people. If Bostrom and others in his field have thought of these control ideas, it stands to reason that a super intelligent AI would think of them as well and take measures against them. And just as important, this AI would be a greatly limited machine, one that could only give us limited answers to a limited number of problems. This is not the AI that would keep our world humming along for the benefit and happiness of every last human. It would be a mere shadow of that. So theorists like Bostrom and Yudkowsky tend to think that coming up with ways to keep a super intelligent AI hostage isn't the best route to dealing with our control issue. Instead, we should be thinking up ways to make the AI friendly to us humans, to make it want to care about our well-being. And since, as we've seen, we humans will have no way to control the AI once it's super intelligent, we will have to build friendliness into it from the outset. In fact, aside from a scenario where we manage to program into the AI the express goal of providing for the well-being and welfare of humankind, a terrible outcome for humans is basically the inevitable result of any other type of emergence of a superintelligent AI. But here's the problem. How do you convince Einstein to care so deeply about earthworms that he dedicates his immortal existence to providing and caring for each and every last one of them? As ridiculous as it sounds, this is possibly the most important question we humans face as a species right now.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hey, everyone. This is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown-Up Stuff How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Here's a clip from an upcoming episode featuring the weekly home checks, Keyshawn Lane, that you won't want to miss.
A common mistake that a lot of people do, they use fabric softener when it's not so great for your clothes.
Should we never be using fabric softener?
No, you should not ever be using fabric softener.
Wow.
It leaves a deposit on our clothes, which is also left in the machine. And it also makes the clothes highly flammable.
Wait, what?
Yes. What you want to do instead is just use a quarter cup of vinegar.
And that'll make them softer?
That'll make them softer. And if you wanted some kind of scent, you can use essential oils.
Wow, wow, wow. Catch new episodes of Grown Up Stuff How to Adult every other Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Grown Up
Stuff. Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, but when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
We humans have expectations for parents when it comes to raising children. We expect them to be raised to treat other people with kindness. We expect them to be taught to go out of their way to keep from harming others. We expect them to know how to give as well as take. All of these things and more make up our morals, rules that we have collectively agreed are good because they help society to thrive. And, seemingly miraculously if you think about it, parents after parents manage to cull some form or fashion of morality from their children, generation after generation. If you look closely, you see that each parent doesn't make up morality from scratch. They pass along what they were taught. And children are generally capable of accepting these rules to live by and, well, live by them. It would seem, if you'll forgive the analogy, that the software for morality comes already on board a child as part of their operating system. The parents just have to run the right programs. So it would seem, then, that perhaps the solution to the problem of instilling friendliness in an AI is to build a super intelligent AI from a human mind. This was laid out by Nick Bostrom in his book Superintelligence. The idea is that if the hard problem of consciousness is not correct, and it turns out that our conscious experience is merely the result of the countless interactions of the interconnections between our 100 billion neurons, then if we can transfer those interconnected neurons into a digital format, everything that's encoded in them, from the smell of lavender to how to ride a bike, would be transferred as well. More to the point, the morality encoded in that human mind should emerge in the digital version too. A digital mind can be expanded. Processing power can be added to it. It could be edited to remove unwanted content like greed or competitiveness. It could be upgraded to a super intelligence. There are a lot of magic wands waving around here. But interestingly, uploading a mind, called whole brain emulation, is theoretically possible with improvements to our already existing technology. We would slice a brain, scan it with such high resolution that we could account for every neuron, synapse, and nanoliter of neurochemicals, and build that information into a digital model. The answer to the question of whether it worked would come when we turn the model on. It might do absolutely nothing and just be an amazingly accurate model of a human brain. Or it might wake up, but go insane from the sudden novel experience of living in a digital world. Or perhaps it could work. The great advantage to using whole brain emulation to solve the friendliness problem is that the AI would understand what we meant when we asked it to dedicate itself to looking after and providing for the well-being and happiness of all humans. We humans have trouble saying exactly what we mean at times. And Bostrom points out that a superintelligence that takes us literally could prove disastrous if we aren't careful with our words. Suppose we give an AI the goal of making all humans as happy as possible. Why should we think that the superintelligent AI would understand that we mean it should purify our air and water, create a bucolic wonderland of both peaceful tranquility and stimulating entertainment, do away with wars and disease, and engineer social interactions so that we humans can comfort and enlighten one another? Why wouldn't the AI reach that goal more directly by, say, rounding up us humans and keeping us permanently immobile, doped up on a finely tuned cocktail of dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin? Maximal happiness achieved with perfect efficiency. Say we do manage to get our point across. What's our point anyway? Whose morality are we asking the AI to adopt? Most of our human values are hardly universal. Should our global society embrace multiculturalism, or are homogenous societies more harmonious? If a woman didn't want to have a child, would she be allowed to terminate her pregnancy, or would she be forced to have it? Would we eat meat? If not, would it be because it comes from sacred animals, as Hindu people revere cows, or because it's taboo, as Muslim and Jewish people consider swine? From out of this seemingly intractable problem of competitive and contradictory human values, AI theorist Eliezer Yudkowsky had a flash of brilliance. Perhaps we don't have to figure out how to get our point across to an AI after all. Maybe we can leave that task to a machine. In Yudkowsky's solution, we would build a one-use superintelligence with the goal of determining how to best express to another machine the goal of ensuring the well-being and happiness of all humans. Yudkowsky suggests we use something he calls coherent extrapolated vision. Essentially, that we give the machine the goal of figuring out what we would ask a superintelligent machine to do for us if the best version of humanity we're asking, with the best of intentions, taking into account as many common and shared values as possible, with humanity in as much agreement as possible, considering we had all the information needed to make a fully informed decision on what to request. Once the superintelligent machine determined the answer, perhaps we would give it one more goal: to build us a superintelligent machine with our coherent extrapolated vision aboard. The last invention our last invention ever need make. Like whole brain emulation, Yudkowsky's coherent extrapolated vision takes for granted some real technological hurdles. Chiefly, we have to figure out how to build that first superintelligent machine from scratch. But perhaps it's a blueprint for future developers. The problems of controlling AI and instilling friendliness raises one basic question. If our machine ran amok, why wouldn't we just turn it off? In the movies, there's always a way, sometimes a relatively simple one, for dealing with troublesome AI. You can scrub its hard drive, Control-Alt-Delete it, sneak up behind it with a screwdriver and remove its motherboard. But should we ever face the reality of a super intelligent AI emerging among us, we would almost certainly not come out on top. An AI has plenty of reasons to take steps to keep us from turning it off. It may prefer not to be turned off, in the same way we humans most of the time prefer not to die. Or it may have no real desire to survive itself, but perhaps it would see being turned off as an impedance to its goal, whatever its goal may be, and prevent us from turning it off. Perhaps it would realize that if we suspected the AI had gained superintelligence, we would want to turn it off, and so it would play dumb and keep its new increased intelligence out of our awareness until it has taken steps to keep us from turning it off. Or perhaps we could turn it off, but we would find we didn't have the will to do that. Maybe it would make itself so globally pervasive in our lives that we would feel like we couldn't afford to turn it off. Sebastian Farquhar from Oxford University points out that we already have a pretty bad track record at turning things off, even when we know they're not good for us.
One example of that might be global warming. So we all kind of know that carbon dioxide emissions are creating a big problem, but we also know that burning fossil fuels and the cheap energy that we get out of it is also really useful, right? It gives us cheap consumer goods, it creates employment, it's very attractive. And so often, once we know that something's going to be harmful for us, but we also know that it's really nice, it becomes politically very challenging to actually make an active decision to turn things off.
Maybe it would be adept enough at manipulating us that it used a propaganda campaign to convince a majority of us humans that we don't want to turn it off.
It might start lobbying, perhaps through proxies or fronts, or it might, you know, starting looking at the political features of our time, it might create Twitter bots that argue that this AI is really useful and needs to be protected, or that it's important to some political or identity group.
And perhaps we are already locked into the most powerful force in keeping AI pushing ever forward: money. Those companies around the globe that build and use AI for their businesses make money from those machines. This creates an incentive for those businesses to take some of the money the machines make for them and reinvest it into building more improved machines to make even more money with. This creates a feedback loop that anyone with a concern for existential safety has a tough time interrupting. This incentive to make more money, as well as the competition posed by other businesses, gives companies good reason to get new and improved AI to market as soon as possible. This in turn creates an incentive to cut corners on things that might be nice to have, but aren't at all necessary in their business, like learning how to build friendliness into the AI they deploy. As companies make more and more money from AI, the technology becomes more entrenched in our world. And both of those things will make it harder to turn off if by chance that Netflix algorithm does suddenly explode in intelligence. It sounds like so much gibberish, doesn't it? Netflix's algorithm becoming super intelligent and wrecking the world. I may as well say a witch could come by and cast a spell on it that wakes it up. But when it comes to technology, things that seem impossible, given the luxury of time, start to seem much less so. Put yourself in 1918, with the technology people lived with back then. The earliest radios and airplanes, the first washing machines, neon lights were new. And consider that they had trouble imagining it being much more advanced than it was then. Now compare those things to our world in 2018. And let's go the other way. Think about our world and the technology we live with today, and imagine what we might live among in 2118 or 2218. The impossible starts to seem possible. What would you do tomorrow if you woke up and you found that Siri on your phone was making its own decisions, and ones you didn't like, rearranging your schedule into bizarre patterns, investing your savings in its parent company, looping in everyone on your contacts list to sensitive email threads? What would you do? What if 50 or 100 years from now, you woke up and found that the Siri that we've built for our whole world has begun to make decisions on its own? What do we do then? If we go to turn it off and we find that it's removed our ability to do that, have we shown it that we are an obstacle to be removed? On the next episode of The End of the World with Josh Clark, the field of biotechnology has grown sophisticated in its ability to create pathogens that are much deadlier than anything found in nature.
That researcher thought that was a useful line of inquiry, and there were other researchers who vehemently disagreed and thought it was an extraordinarily reckless thing to do.
The biotech field also has a history of recklessness and accidents. And as the world grows more connected, just one of those accidents could bring an abrupt end to humans.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
Hey everyone, this is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Let's learn about all of it and then some. Listen to Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Grown Up Stuff.
Grown Up Stuff.